Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Juravich. Over the past few months, President Trump has been deploying the National Guard to cities. First Los Angeles, then Washington, D.C., more recently Memphis, and he says Chicago will be next. 150 members of the Ohio National Guard were sent to D.C., which was approved by Governor Mike DeWine. President Trump and others argue that crime is so rampant in these areas, they need outside help, while others say these matters should stay in the hands of local police. Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Sarah Donaldson recently wrote about whether the Ohio National Guard will be sent to more cities in the future. Welcome to All Sides, Sarah.
Hey, Amy. Good to be here.
So it seems like President Trump is adding a new city to his list of cities needing help with crime every day. Do you think that there are any Ohio cities on his radar when he makes these lists?
You know, obviously, I haven't asked President Trump about it, but I have asked Senator Bernie Moreno about that. And I know one city that Moreno pointed to is Cleveland. Cleveland's crime statistics are generally higher than those in Washington, D.C., which, of course, and that I'm talking about violent crime when I'm talking about crime statistics, because, of course, crime stats are generally broken out between violent crime and then also property crime. So Cleveland's violent crime rate in 2024 was higher than Washington, D.C.'s. Now, when I asked Moreno about 2 weeks ago, he says that he hopes that leaders in the city are willing to take help from both the state and the federal government before it gets to the point of deploying the National Guard, but he didn't rule it out. I've also asked Governor Mike DeWine about this, though, and DeWine is in kind of a sticky situation here because, of course, DeWine has agreed to deploy National Guard members, Ohio National Guard members, to other cities outside of Ohio. But if Trump asks him to deploy National Guard in Ohio, that's probably going to be in contrast with what an Ohio mayor is telling DeWine. So he said he does not anticipate a situation where any National Guard members are deployed to Ohio cities to tackle violent crime. He says there are better ways to do that.
Now, Governor DeWine has received a lot of criticism for sending the National Guard to D.C. He's repeatedly said, you know, explained his rationale for why they're there. Can you again explain why he agreed to send them to Washington, D.C.?
He defends the decision because he says that he has done this across the political spectrum. When Democratic governors have requested the National Guard, he's sent them, whether it be for, you know, the civil unrest that we saw after the killing of George Floyd in 2020. He's also sent the National Guard to both Republican and Democratic states when there's been a natural disaster, some sort of an emergency situation. But that is the more defined role for the National Guard. Of course, you know, using the National Guard to try and defray violent crime stats is a little more unusual.
In one of your reports, DeWine talked about the National Guard being in D.C. to protect D.C., not to deal with the violent crime. So what does he say the goal is? Are they like protecting monuments? They're not dealing with violent criminals.
So that's pretty much my understanding of based on what DeWine has said, is that the National Guard being there eases some of the strains that were put on the local police forces and on the National Guard that's already based in D.C. He says, so they're not working, you know, these crazy amounts of hours. I mean, of course, you've seen reports about some of these National Guard members are doing landscaping. So it sounds like there's a variety of duties. Of course, you know, this has been a really divisive issue. You've seen Republicans really support it and Democrats really criticize it, which is, you know, pretty much anything these days. But DeWine has defended it because he said that in addition to, you know, he does this for members of both political parties because he is kind of the chief of command for the Ohio National Guard. He also says that it eases the strain that's put on local law enforcement, so that they're able to do, if they're not maybe monitoring traffic, you know, if they have to be directing traffic, if the National Guard's able to do that, that frees them up to work the streets.
Now, DeWine said that he doesn't believe the National Guard will be sent to Ohio cities, but is he worried about the crime rate in Cleveland?
He is, and I believe he recently sent some sort of a state task force up to Cleveland. I'd have to check on that because that was my colleague Joe Ingles reporting, who recently did a story on that.
It might have been the Highway Patrol. I heard that this morning too, but I think I missed the exact detail of the name of it.
It's all, there's so much news and it develops so quickly. But I will say he's pointed to what was successful in Cincinnati, in his opinion. So Cincinnati's crime rate, as well as Columbus's crime rate, violent crime, again, those are both lower than Washington, D.C.'s. So that's important to note. But in Cincinnati, of course, you had that high-profile case where there was a street brawl. The details are still coming out. Very politicized incident. DeWine, you know, tackled that with kind of a local law enforcement approach and also surging state resources, not the National Guard. So he's kind of pointing to a response like what he did in Cincinnati, if that's needed in Cleveland or elsewhere.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about crime statistics and the Ohio National Guard with Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Sarah Donaldson. So the other Ohio cities, you mentioned Columbus and Cincinnati, have lower crime rates than Cleveland. Has there been any talk? You know, there's the Youngstowns, the Daytons, the Toledos. I mean, there's lots of places to worry about crime, I guess, for Bernie Moreno, for Governor DeWine too.
Yeah, and of course for local leaders as well, because you know, it's something that I think politicians at all levels talk about crime, and of course on both sides, but it truly is the people who feel it most are the people who are living in the cities and experiencing crime, whether it's, you know, higher, whether the rate is high or low. If you're a victim of a crime, it feels very personal to you and it feels very real to you. I do know that based on some calculations that Cleveland.com did, and if you look at FBI data, and of course, even some of that data and how these police units report crime has been criticized by the Trump administration and by Bernie Moreno. But some of those smaller Ohio cities do have slightly higher crime rates. Again, I think you do see a situation, and what DeWine has said too, if the National Guard is going to be deployed in Ohio, it's more likely going to be if there's some sort of civil unrest or if there's something major that happens in the city that requires that response. But just based on the violent crime rates, not so much.
Violent crime does not just happen in Democratic-leaning cities. The suspect in Charlie Kirk's murder was a right-wing supporter, and it happened in a very red state, Utah. Do you think that this might impact, I know you don't know President Trump's decisions, but it could impact what Bernie Moreno says or Mike DeWine whenever they are talking about the use of the National Guard and where they go?
I don't want to conflate two issues because I do think a political assassination is probably very different than crime on the streets or crime in a city. And of course, you know, we're still learning a lot about what the motive was of Robinson, Tyler Robinson, the person who's alleged to have shot and killed Charlie Kirk. I do think that, you know, it was a crime. It was a very public crime. There were a lot of people who were witness to it. And I certainly think, you know, you've seen a lot of condemning of political violence, which I think this falls into that category. But I see them as two different issues right now. And in the immediate response, what I've seen from lawmakers, particularly Republican lawmakers, has been looking more at how people who commit violent crimes are then, and political crimes specifically, like political assassination, are then prosecuted. So, for example, I'm following a bill today that would kind of put the death penalty as in question for political assassinations. Like that could be the punishment for a political assassination in Ohio. And of course, in Utah, they are seeking out the death penalty. So, you know, I haven't heard as much. I was at a rally on, I'm sorry, it was not a rally. It was a vigil on Sunday in support and memorializing Charlie Kirk. And you didn't hear a lot about the National Guard or about crime. It was more so about political violence.
Yeah, back to the crime stats for one quick second. That, you know, a lot of crime goes underreported. Crime stats may not be accurate. That's what a lot of people say, that that crime is underreported. And there's been instances of glitches in the reporting system in the past as well. I mean, as a reporter, you know, you love to report data. So how do you know, or how do we know if the Ohio crime statistics are being formulated properly?
It's really hard to say, and this is something that you might laugh at me, but I actually go back. My favorite television show on earth is The Wire. I don't know if you've watched The Wire, but it is obviously a fictional show. But in the show, you know, the police departments are accused of cooking the books. You know, they're told to kind of juke the stats in a way that either benefits them or doesn't benefit them. So there have been, I mean, real life cases of police departments, you know, trying to work with the stats. And in addition, you talk about crime going underreported. So for example, this is an instance of property crime, not violent crime, but I was in a hit and run in Columbus. Someone hit my car and totaled my car. That's a felony. I didn't report it to the police because by the time I got back to my car, the person was gone. I couldn't find any evidence. I couldn't find ring camera evidence. So that's, you know, a felony hit and run right there that didn't go reported. So crime does go underreported because people choose not to report it for whatever reason. So, you know, it's hard to say if you're getting a super accurate picture. With violent crime, I got to imagine it's a little less so, of course, though, because when you think about homicide, for example, I think it's pretty rare for homicides to go like significantly underreported.
So whenever you you mentioned that you went to the vigil and you talked with you had a report on this morning where you talked with young Republicans and young Democrats about their feelings of just the way politics is playing out here after the Charlie Kirk murder. But did you get a feeling that they're worried about crime overall, or is it kind of, there is that separation where what's happening with the National Guard in these cities and this political assassination are separate issues?
I definitely think there's that separation. Again, I think what they're thinking about more right now is, again, platforming political figures, bringing political figures onto college campuses, because college campuses have long been a forum for political figures. I mean, you know, I think back to, I was at Ohio University when Caitlin Bennett, like people called her Kent State Gun Girl, she was on campus and people ran her off campus with toilet paper. I mean, Ohio and all colleges across the country have always been this place where controversial figures, non-controversial figures go to speak. And I think, you know, the college students who organize those events and bring those speakers to campus feel this extra burden that they have to make sure that these people are safe. And of course, you know, there's often, if it's a big speaker, if it's a notable name on the right, on the left, there's going to be security. I talked to a Republican at Miami University, and he helped organize an event that brought Ben Shapiro, he's a conservative commentator, to campus last year. They had metal detectors, they had police present. But, you know, he was like, I don't know that I'd ever want to have an outdoor event after watching what happened with Kirk. So I don't know that they feel as wary of crime on campus. And again, I talked to people at both Dayton and at Miami. You know, it might be a different situation at Ohio State, where you're right in the middle of Columbus, which is a major city. But they certainly felt uneasy about this assassination, because of course, this is also just a line of several high profile political assassinations and attempts at political assassination. You know, the Speaker of the House in Minnesota, of course, the assassination attempt on President Donald Trump's life. I mean, you know, this has been just, I think this has been also building up on the side.
I want to thank you for your time. You've been listening to Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Sarah Donaldson. Thanks for being with us today, Sarah.
Thanks so much, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to talk more about crime statistics. Where do they come from? Are they reliable? And what should we use them for? That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Crime statistics are confusing, with most reports, like the reports from the FBI, showing that violent crime has decreased. The media and the public are observing and claiming the opposite. With violent crime dominating the news cycle, it's easy to see how someone would assume that crime is up and getting worse. Are crime statistics reliable? We're speaking with Professor Maria Haberfeld from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, Department of Law. She specializes in police science and criminal justice administration. Welcome to All Sides, Professor Haberfeld.
Thank you for having me.
So what do you think is the main reason that all of this rhetoric about the rise in crime and crime is up, why is that happening? Why do you think people think crime is on the rise?
I don't think that this is just a matter of perception. So, I mean, you know, people tend to say numbers don't lie, but numbers can lie, and it depends on a number of factors like misclassification, reclassification of crimes. So, for example, law enforcement agencies might claim that robberies are down, right? It's one of the 7 major crimes that is encoded by NYPD. But it depends how these robberies are classified. Some robberies will be misclassified or reclassified into menacing, which eliminates this particular event from the statistics. Shootings, for example. Shootings will be classified as shootings only if the police will find shells at the scene of the crime. If they don't find the shells, it will be classified as just noise. So, you know, relying on numbers when it comes to whether crime is going up and down is can be misleading. And I think that people understand this now. And when they walk the streets of large cities and they don't feel comfortable, they see various quality of life infractions on each and every corner. And these are mostly misdemeanors, but people don't think about crime in these categories. They think whether I'm safe or not. So somebody is screaming on the corner is not going to be classified as one of the major 7 crimes. But from the perspective of me as an individual, I feel uncomfortable. I feel unsafe. And unfortunately, this is what we are seeing.
Yeah. And do you think that we see more crime on our phones or the media is reporting it more and more? It's the lead story on all like late local news. So do you think that people ultimately believe crime is all around us because it's just we have the internet in our pocket so we can see it more?
Definitely we can see it more, but this is not new. We can see it more for years right now. You know, it was more of a phenomenon when we just started with the social media, but we are deep into the social media era. So I think it's really the individual perception. It's something that, you know, we are experiencing in the United States. I was in Greece last week for a conference, and I had no problems walking the streets of Athens. It's a big city in the middle of the night. I cannot say the same about New York.
Interesting. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about crime statistics with John Jay College of Criminal Justice Professor Maria Haberfeld. So here in Ohio, In 2024, the police uncovered a data glitch that caused them to underreport about 165,000 crime incidents since 2013. So this is in Columbus. And the Columbus police chief said that over those 11 years, the statistics were reported but not logged correctly. So let's hear from, this is Columbus Police Chief Elaine Bryant.
It was simply not logged in correctly as it relates to the documentation in our technology, but the crimes were actually reported. Mm-hmm. They just were not being logged in correctly. And so immediately, as soon as our deputy chiefs have acknowledged and recognized that this was happening, we immediately started working towards ensuring that those numbers were being reported accurately to the federal government.
Now, she said that on my show a few months ago, and I didn't know enough about it to, like, push back, because I'm not sure what she means when she says that they were reported but not logged correctly. Can we trust crime statistics after you hear something like that, if human error is that easy?
But this is exactly what I said at the beginning of our conversation. It's crimes are reported, but they're misclassified. And they're, you know, they reclassify various crimes, especially the serious crimes, to make them misdemeanors, so they don't have to be reported to the FBI, for example. And this is what gives us this false sense of crime is going down, crime is going down. You know, I'm watching crime is going down for decades now. If I were to trust all the statistics, there wouldn't be any crime today, right? Because if it's going down every year, with some years it's a little bit, it's up here, it's up there. But overall, you know, it's always, especially around elections. Suddenly we are seeing this laser focus of crime is down. But, you know, we have to understand that people commit crimes not necessarily because of police presence or lack of police presence. People commit crimes for a variety of reasons. And it's almost like the economy. Not always we can explain why crime is going up or down. But overall, I still would like to emphasize that I think there is an individual fear that is based on what people experience, especially in large cities nowadays. And it has much less to do with the intensity of what we're seeing on social media, but it's based on individual perceptions, not necessarily observing the heinous crimes like the murders or rapes, but literally observing the various quality of lives violations that make them feel uncomfortable. And from this, they extrapolate further.
Is there a better way, in your opinion, to be collecting crime stats? Is there a way police departments and even the FBI should be doing it differently so that everyone in every city is categorizing it the same way?
I don't think it's so important to measure crime. I think it's more about understanding why people commit crimes. And doing something about this, right? If somebody is involved in a domestic violence situation, for example, they're going to continue to be involved in the domestic violence situation no matter how many police officers are going to be on the corner. If somebody is selling drugs and making this tremendous profit, they will continue to do so. There is very little in the literature that supports really, you know, the deterrence theory that if we're going to have more serious punishments or harder, you know, approach to crime, it will disappear. It only works on an individual level. If somebody committed a crime is going to be incarcerated, yes, that person is not going to commit crimes. But, you know, we're not going to solve the gang problems. We're not going to solve the drug problems. We're not going to solve individual domestic violence related crimes. So I don't think it's about measuring. It's about focusing more on why people do it and looking how we can intervene at that level.
You did mention a few minutes ago that if something is recategorized from a violent crime to more of a misdemeanor, then it's not counted. So do we not count or report misdemeanors? Is that?
No, not really. No, we don't. No, we don't. We really focus on, especially in New York City, on the seven majors.
What are the seven majors that we do focus on?
So we're talking about murder, robbery, grand larceny, grand auto larceny, goodness, I'm now.
That's okay.
On that, 7. Yes, but
that was
but,
close. That's close enough to 7.
Yeah. No, but you know, as I said before, one of these examples is robber, right? So robber, as I said before, can be misclassified as menacing, depending how the report is taken. It's about how the reports are taken and how, for example, the number of events occurring in criminal events occurring in one location. Technically speaking, they should be classified as 6 grand larcenies, but they can be classified as 1 because they occur at the same location. So there are various ways to manipulate the numbers.
Do you think
and at the end of the day, as I said before, does it really matter how many grand larcenies were committed in this location? No, what matters is why people committed these grand larcenies. And this is where we are missing the point.
Do you feel like smaller cities do a better job or have an easier job whenever reporting violent crimes because they don't have as many? Do you think that the how good crime statistics are varies based on like the city size or department to department?
I think it's a political issue. It depends on the pressure on police chiefs and commissioners. People tend to forget that police chiefs and commissioners are appointed by the mayors, and different mayors have different views depending on the election timing, what's important, what they want to emphasize. I don't necessarily think that it's directly related to smaller cities, but of course, in smaller cities, if you just take a look at gang activity, if hundreds of different gangs in New York City or LA for that matter, or Chicago, of course, this is a menacing situation that makes it much more difficult for a police force to deal with. And for a smaller city that do not have this type of criminal activity, it's easier not to engage in manipulation or reclassification because they simply don't have the same level of criminal activity.
What do you make of the recent times where President Trump is sending the National Guard to cities like LA and Washington, D.C., and now Memphis, maybe Chicago soon, because crime is rampant in those cities and they need help? What do you make of this whole idea of politicizing crime, basically using crime statistics or not, but just saying crime is up as a part of politics and kind of the fear mongering there? What do you make of that?
As I said before, people will not stop committing crimes because there is a presence of a certain number of law enforcement officers or National Guard. They will stop maybe for this particular period of time, and then they will continue, or they will go someplace else. The phenomenon of displacement is a well-known phenomenon. Nobody will stop selling drugs just because there is a higher presence of law enforcement or National Guard officers on the grounds. It will just have an immediate effect for maybe a few days, maybe a few weeks, but then it will be back to business. Unfortunately, again, we are moving away from understanding how to tackle crime. We are focusing on numbers, and we push numbers as a solution to crime, to dealing with crime, to containing crime. That's not a solution and never has been.
So what should we be focusing on if we don't focus on numbers? You mentioned a few times we need to focus on why people commit crimes. Yeah. How do we figure that out?
Well, you know, we know. Gang research is, I don't know, 70 years old. We have a lot of best practices of how to tackle gang activities. We have to invest more in education, right? We have to invest more in social services. This is something that we know for decades, not just for years. But we do not invest. There are some programs that get some notoriety, but a program or a different approach that has minimal resources, minimal funding, vis-a-vis hundreds of different gangs, that's a drop in the ocean. We just need to shift our focus on education, on social services.
Whenever I talked to the Columbus Police Chief, Elaine Bryant, she talked about how departments like hers have added social workers to their response teams, especially when it comes to domestic violence. So they don't necessarily always send just police, but they'll send social workers. Is that kind of what you're talking about in trying to figure it, like help people in a different way?
Well, you know, I mean, Columbus, Ohio can afford maybe to have the social workers necessary vis-a-vis the domestic violence problems that they have. But if you're talking about larger cities, we would need to recruit thousands of social workers to respond to domestic violence situations. And definitely corresponding teams also exist, you know, over 30 years, I would say, at this point. And there is a certain level of improvement in police response when they have corresponding teams. It's simply not realistic to think that larger cities can afford the recruitment of hundreds, if not thousands, of social workers that will be available 24/7. Because let's not forget that people commit these crimes, you know, around the clock. How many social workers will have during each and every shift? So ideas are good, but the implementation is not realistic.
Hmm. Do you feel like the collecting of crime statistics then is kind of a waste of time if they're not useful and they're not helpful?
I do. I truly do. Mm. We are focusing on numbers, and numbers do lie.
Mm. So what would you like to see if the resources that are used into inputting all this data in every police department and the resources the FBI put into compiling crime statistics, where should they turn their attention?
Definitely should turn their attention to corresponding team, to recruiting people with different skills levels to work with police officers, domestic violence being one of the examples, but also gang awareness. I mean, most of the police departments don't have researchers and individuals who specialize in activities. They just rely on their street experience, but I would include researchers on gang activities, on etiology of gangs, why people join gangs, to help them understand what kind of responses and what kind of focus they need to have. You know, many police chiefs nowadays, police commissioners, they use this semi-academic terms like, you know, we have precision policing, and I'm thinking, do you even understand what you're saying? You know, it's like, what does it mean, precision policing? You're focusing on a corner when you have gang activity, they will move to another corner. Mm. Precision policing to me is understanding why they're on the corner to begin with.
Well, we've been talking with Professor Maria Haberfeld from John Jay College of Criminal Justice in the Department of Law. She specializes in police science and criminal justice administration. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk about what happens when anger and fear related to crimes begins to dominate our politics as well. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. With the most recent FBI statistics showing that violent crime has decreased, politicians and officials continue to claim crime is on the rise. What are the effects of a politician's fear-mongering? Is fear being used as a political weapon? Joining us now is Professor William Gauston, Senior Fellow of the Brookings Institute's Governance Studies Program. He recently published a book titled Anger, Fear, Domination: Dark Passions and the Power of Political Speech. Welcome to All Sides, Professor Gauston. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. While the most recent FBI crime statistics show that violent crime has decreased, politicians and officials claim that crime is on the rise.
What are the effects of politician fear-mongering? And is fear being used as a political weapon? Joining us now is Professor William Galston, Senior Fellow of the Brookings Institute's Governance Studies Program. He recently published a book titled Anger, Fear, Domination, Dark Passions and the Power of Political Speech. Welcome to All Sides, Professor Galston.
It's great to be here, Amy.
So earlier in the show, we were talking about the National Guard being used in cities like L.A. and D.C., and we also were talking about crime statistics. But I've read that fear of crime is a useful political tool, even if the data doesn't back it up. Do you agree with that?
Well, sure, with a but. Mm-hmm. And that is that official statistics don't necessarily capture how the public is feeling. And if people feel unsafe for whatever reason, reciting statistics about declining crime rates mm-hmm. just makes them matter. So it's a complicated situation. It's tempting to blame fear of crime on politicians who are trying to exploit it for their own purposes, and that's part of the truth. But the broader truth is that people can feel unsafe for all sorts of reasons and that are not necessarily captured by the statistics. And by the way, a few years ago, I sponsored and led a project at Brookings, you know, to try to nail down crime statistics. Mm-hmm. And I was really startled to discover how incomplete they are.
We just talked with a professor in the last segment, and she said that we should just forget about crime statistics altogether and worry and put our focus on why people commit crimes and not even bother gathering them because they're so unreliable. What do you think of that?
That's a little bit more extreme than I would put the point, but I would certainly say that crime statistics should be used with caution. Because of all sorts of reporting problems, many of the different agencies don't use comparable categories to count crime. And so I would focus on how people are reporting their feelings about the crime level and taking seriously their testimony as to what it would take to make them feel safer. Mm.
Your book was published before the most recent murder of political activist Charlie Kirk. So obviously you had written this book before that happened. But when you started to write this book, were there any specific events that triggered you to make you have this idea that you wanted to write a book about anger, fear, and domination?
Where do I start? I have been writing about the rise of complaints about liberal democracy for decades now. It's been one of my central topics. And I could see that people in the United States and throughout the democracy, Western democracies, were getting more and more fearful of the future, more and more angry about being overlooked, as many of them thought they were, by political elites, and more open to leaders who, you know, promised to break through the gridlock, break through the stagnation, and get things back on the right track for their, you know, for the citizens they were trying to lead. And I could also see, if you look at countries like Hungary and Turkey and India and others, that was potentially leading in undemocratic directions because people who wanted to dominate their societies were using these sentiments of anger and fear. They were mobilizing them and whipping them up for their own purposes. So that, in brief, was what led me to write this book. And frankly, when I began thinking about it, I wasn't thinking principally about the United States. I was thinking about international trends. But distressingly, what I started writing about more than 10 years ago, 15 actually, is is now relevant to our domestic circumstances.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about crime fear-mongering with Professor William Galston, author of the book Anger, Fear, Domination, Dark Passions and the Power of Political Speech. You know, persuasive speech is the power behind politics, you know, persuading people to vote for you. That's kind of the point of politics. So where is the line, in your opinion, between persuading and fear-mongering?
Well, when I was a young man, I studied ancient Greece very, very seriously and the writings of the great Greek philosophers. And they described, you know, Plato in his dialogues and Aristotle in several of his books, the different ways in which persuasion can be carried out. And some people persuade on the basis of their character, right? So if you were George Washington, you didn't have to do that much, you know, except show up. People trusted you because of who you were. Another way of persuading people is through facts, logic, evidence. And that sometimes works. A third way of persuading people is by appealing to their passions and emotions. And that was true in ancient Greece, and it's true today. And appealing to people's passions and emotions is not necessarily a bad thing. It depends on the passions and emotions you're appealing to. You know, if you're appealing to sentiments of charity, or hope, or love, or many other, or patriotism, or a shared history, the list of positive sentiments goes on and on. But it's equally possible to persuade people through the negative, or what I call the dark passions. And unfortunately, we are seeing too much persuasion and mobilization based on that sort of appeal. And it has made many Americans and citizens of other countries very unhappy about the tone and content of their politics.
Earlier in the program, we talked about President Trump deploying the National Guard in several cities. This has caused some panic, a lot of uproar. Mayors in many of those cities don't want the intervention. So what's the average person supposed to think when one politician says everything is fine and the other politician says we need the National Guard immediately? How do you figure out who to trust?
For most people, most of the time, it's by appealing to their own experience and their own sentiments about that experience. So to repeat what I said at the beginning, if you're feeling unsafe, you may welcome additional law enforcement, even if it's not local law enforcement. And I can tell you, I'm talking to you from a suburb near Washington, D.C., and the reaction in Washington, D.C. has been, at least to my eye, surprisingly mixed. You know, some people are denouncing it as an invasion of home rule by the district, as a reduction of their sovereignty and self-determination. But others, including some people in the most crime-sensitive regions of the city, are saying, well, I'm not sure I like the National Guard here, but I do feel safer when I see them patrolling the streets at night. Mm-hmm. And the mayor of the District of Columbia has to some extent welcomed the intervention while also criticizing it on various grounds. So how are ordinary people supposed to feel, your question?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they, in circumstances where you can have some direct experience, you are more likely to trust your own experience than you are some politician or leader telling you how you're feeling or how you should feel. When people don't have direct experience, whatever the controversy is, then they're very, very vulnerable to media presentations or characterizations of an issue by leaders they trust. But as I said, if you are experiencing an economic downturn in your own household, a leader quoting statistics to the effect that you've never had it so good is not likely to shape your feelings. And the same goes with crime.
You've been listening to Professor William Galston, Senior Fellow of the Brookings Institution's Governance Studies Program. He recently published a book titled Anger, Fear, Domination, Dark Passions and the Power of Political Speech. Professor, thank you for your time today.
It's been a pleasure, Amy.
And this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.